Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Bentham, both pastors of Christ Church in Haywards Heath. This week we're talking about the sensitive issue of pornography. We talk about the change that has taken place over the last few decades in both the accessibility and acceptability of pornography. We talk about the differences between the secular and Christian views on whether these changes are a good thing or a bad thing, and consider why God has prohibited sex outside of marriage in any context, whether that's an arbitrary prohibition. Is God a spoilsport, or does he really know and want what's best for us? So let's get into it and I'll catch you on the other side.
Hi. I'm Mark Bentham.
Hello, and I'm Graham Nichols.
And I'm Josh Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary. This week we are talking about pornography, and before we get into some of the details about that, I want Graham to give us a rundown of why we're going to do a whole podcast about this. So give us some thoughts.
Yeah, it's obviously quite a sensitive subject to talk about, and we want to make sure that as we talk about it that we're sensitive to where people are at and listening, and we're not trying to be judgmental or suggest that we're perfect in this. So, you know, we have to confess our own sort of vulnerabilities in this as we do it. But I think the reason we want to do it is because it is a really significant issue for many people, both men and women. Historically, it's been more of a problem with men, but it is also for women as well. And so we want to kind of be honest about the reality of that. When I was growing up, it was hard to see any pornography kind of shows unless you actually went to a kind of dodgy cinema or something. And other than that, you could just buy magazines. And that's obviously, even though I'm not really, really old, that's obviously dramatically changed in my lifetime and even over the last 10 years, where the availability of pornographic material has just mushroomed, you know, to the point that you can get it kind of anywhere and everywhere, pretty much any electronic device. So I think the availability means the temptations are different than how they used to be. The opportunities to watch it are different. So that's kind of another reason. I think practically speaking, when it comes to Christians, it's hard to get hard statistics. But I think from speaking to pastors and from our own experience, it's a topic that often comes up in pastoral discussions. Thinking about people in actual leadership of churches, it's often been an issue with some of those who've had to step down. So it's obviously a big deal that's going on. We try to talk about it a bit in our church. We don't want to talk about it all the time as though it's the only thing going on, but it's a subject that needs to be spoken about so people can feel both convicted that it's an issue, but also that they also feel the gospel impact on that, that they're also still welcomed and accepted and loved, and that the church needs to help them, the church family needs to help them in seeking to deal with that as they seek to become more like Christ. So that's why we're talking about it.
Yeah, I think the other is not, in terms of pornography, just the availability, actually. I think the other big shift is the acceptability.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think even when and I'm much younger than Graham, when I was at school, it wasn't that available, but actually it wasn't that acceptable. It was still kind of hidden. It was the one slightly quirky kid who had it. Still that kind of, you didn't really talk about it. Whereas I think the shift, and I think that shift began with like episodes of Friends, where they talked about porn as okay, and they were watching, as couples.
Yeah.
And I think the big shift now is just accepted as if it's fine. And in fact, within the world, it's healthy. It's part of healthy sexual relationships to watch porn together. And I think that's part of the problem. A huge bit of the problem is the availability and the acceptability of it, that it's acceptable to watch. It's not a bad thing. It's healthy. And I think what we're finding, and I think the world would back, is actually culturally now the stats are saying, no, it's not healthy.
Yeah.
And actually, hence the laws that are coming into our country that are making it virtually, well, as hard as it can be for under 18s to watch porn on you know, on screen and stuff. You have to sign up, don't you, recently? You're going to have to show evidence of your age. And I think they're all good things, which we're certainly recognising.
Do we have a working definition of pornography that we could work with?
Explicit material of a sexual nature.
Yeah, but then I suppose you could say lots of films in kind of mainstream TV would have that. And kind of increasingly so. So there's a kind of an overlap. I think it has to do with quantity and it has to do with intention, I would have thought. So I think in terms of quantity, it's a film or a video clip of some sort made with the sole intention of sexual stimulation rather than some other artistic piece. You know, you can argue about whether some other artistic pieces have too much sex in them or whatever, but they're not made with that sort of sole purpose. So I think it's to do with the sort of the purpose of the making of them and the sort of quantity. So, you know, basically if you have a movie that's on mainstream TV that is basically all about sex and showing sex with whatever artistic intention, you'd probably say that's pornography because the quantity is just disproportionate. And, you know, whatever the intention. So I think the intention of the filmmaker is the intention of you watching it and the sort of the balance of what the thing is about. But I think we're not going to talk about it now, but there is a whole area of kind of discernment in what you watch generally, because I think sometimes what we're watching in non-pornographic material is maybe developing a bit of an appetite for pornographic material. So I think that's worth thinking about as well. But I think in terms of pornography and what we're talking about just now, we're thinking really about material that's designed to sexually stimulate and that's watched for sexual stimulation.
And what about the added factor of our culture being just hypersexualized in advertising, in the films that we watch? Like you said, I think the general threshold has changed, hasn't it? So what would have been considered as explicit 50 years ago would now be, you know, child's play.
Yes.
And so I think what you said about being careful about what we watch generally is that can be tough because almost everything has that element of sexual kind of showing something to do with sex or having, you know, it's just ever present.
Yes.
Does that had an impact as well?
Yeah, I think so. As I said, I think it kind of feeds into a sort of desire, or maybe it kind of lowers the threshold or higher the threshold, whichever it is, to the point where it becomes more and more acceptable. So watching pornography becomes a smaller step, is what I'm trying to say. Because, oh, well, I've seen people having sex before, so this is not that much different, you know. So I think that it helps kind of build a case, perhaps, in our heads for it being not so bad, because we're seeing it on sort of other things that we're watching, you know, sometimes watching with our family, albeit slightly awkwardly sometimes.
But I think when we're talking about this particularly is that is an issue, and I think that's probably another podcast. Yeah. But I think what we're moving into is the area where it's becoming an addiction, and where guys and girls, and I think that it's not just guys, it is girls as well, who are spending a significant amount of time daily or of their week watching pornography on some media platform.
Yeah.
And I think that's the nature of it, really, hidden that we're talking about. And actually, what we're seeing is within the life of the church, that's becoming a wrestle for a number of folks.
Why do we think it's wrong?
Yeah, why is it a big deal? Let's talk about that.
From a Christian point of view.
Well, there's the question, isn't it? Well, I think, obviously, I mean, for starters, God has designed sexual relationships for marriage. And so within the marriage context, so therefore any sexual relationship outside of that parameter is wrong biblically, and therefore anything that is then seeking to profile that or to stimulate me in a way that actually is not in a relationship with my wife or the husband is therefore wrong. I mean, in many ways you could let me tell you, it's a form of adultery.
Yeah.
In one sense, because you are mentally having a relationship with another woman or man that is not your husband or your wife, even though it's on a screen. And I think that's part of where, because I don't think any of our guys would be thinking, oh, actually, I'm going to go and have an affair.
No.
Or, you know, but actually, seemingly, are not seeing it in that same way when they're kind of affection, you know, and Jesus, Matthew 5 says, you know, yeah. even you have lust in your heart, you've committed adultery.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we've got to see the seriousness of this. And actually the implication is it is addictive.
Yeah.
And it starts off, you know, with soft porn, to use language, and gets harder yeah. in terms of you have to watch stuff that's is more graphic, more detailed in order to be stimulated. And so therefore, you know, this is a serious area of a battle of sin.
And I think where it cashes out as well is the addiction, but also the dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
So ironically, I think what it creates is a dissatisfaction with any sexual activity that we actually have.
Yeah.
Because it creates this kind of idealized model kind of on the screen, or that's kind of not attainable, and that's just a fantasy. So it actually creates dissatisfaction over here. And then there's the addiction point as well, where you start to kind of gear your life around it, and it dominates your thoughts and maybe even time and money. That's and kind of goes underground. So, you know, those are all things that flow from it. But, you know, but fundamentally, it's about attaching our hearts and affections away from the way that God intended.
So is it arbitrary that God says that sex outside of marriage, in this case, talking about pornography, is a bad thing? Is that an arbitrary decision from God? What, you know, is there damage involved? Why has God said this? Why has God put these prohibitions in place?
I think because it's part of how he designed humanity to live in covenant relationship, live in covenant relationships of men and women together for life, in which sex and children would happen. So I think there's a kind of, that's the way the world works best thing. But I think there's also a big narrative, which is God is playing out in human history, in the good that's happening in human history, the good of God and his people, Christ and the church. And so actually fidelity, faithfulness in that is really important, because you're reflecting how God is with his people. And actually violating that in our thoughts or actions is kind of breaking apart that. So you're not only just doing wrong in terms of human life, you're kind of doing wrong in terms of the big narrative of God, because faithfulness and truth and commitment is really important to God. So I think that's why it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that God asks us to do that's not good. And so, you know, when we talk about kind of sexual prohibition, it always seems like, you know, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. Rather than, this is what's really good. People committing together in lifelong relationships. Not everyone can experience that. We know that. But that is the good way to experience it. And there's not another good way.
And I think that, helpfully, the science supports that as well, doesn't it? The studies have been done. We, like I think you said earlier, that, you know, we know now that this is not healthy,
yeah.
that this causes addiction, that this is not, even if you take the biblical argument away, almost like the abortion argument,
yeah.
science is showing no, there is a better way.
And, yeah.
and hence why the government are putting in laws to protect children
exactly,
now, you know, in ways that they hadn't done previously. And you know, as a parent, I think we've got to keep having these conversations with our kids, actually, because, you know, they live and breathe the air of schools that are hugely secular, where kids are actually at increasingly younger age hypersexualized, and actually, you know, having these conversations about the goodness of God's you know, definition of sex and where sex should be actually needs to be starting to be had, not when they're 10, but probably when they're 3, 4, 5 at appropriate level, that you're having those kind of conversations much, much younger. You know, we were chatting with our kids about this whole area of sex probably when they were maybe 5, 6, something like that, appropriate. And it's just meant that actually from there on, it's kind of had quite an openness about it, which I think has been good. It's also been awkward at times, those awkward conversations where the grandparents are present, that you know, the grandparents have never experienced, you know, it just wasn't done in their day. But, you know, I think it's a healthy thing. But I think increasingly I'm convicted we've got to have these conversations much younger, because if you're not having the conversation as Christian parents, then the schools will be, or their friends will be. And we want to get in there and start teaching about the goodness of sexual relationships with God. But we're moving slightly away from the issue of pornography, because I think part of the other reason we want to talk about it is that because it's such a big issue in the church, and I think as we meet with guys, we're particularly having to tackle this issue. Tim Chester, in his helpful book on it, you know, he says, actually, you've got to ask the question now in every one-to-one, you know, are you wrestling with pornography? And sadly, many are. You know, it's a real battle. And we're not talking just single guys. We're talking guys who are married as well. Yeah. And I think that's part of the difficulty. So then how do you pastor these guys? You know, how do you care for them? You know, what do you do?
I think it starts with a culture of confession, doesn't it? Where we might ask the question, but we also want to show that we're, as pastors and as other Christian friends who are chatting with people, we're not going to be shocked. We're open to hearing and inviting people to say, this is what I'm struggling with, rather than, you know, you can have a conversation that, whether it says it explicitly or not, says, I don't do pornography. I don't think people should do pornography, so I don't expect you to be doing it. So the person kind of listening to you, you know, not literally saying those words, but kind of maybe giving that idea, might just be thinking, well, you know, I'm struggling a bit, but I couldn't possibly tell him because, you know, he's going to think really badly of me. So I think having a culture where you're open. So I think it does start with acknowledgement of the problem. And I know some people might just stop at that and we've got to say some other things. They might just say, well, now I've told someone that it's all right. But I think it is a really good start. You know, so I'm sometimes surprised in some conversations when someone tells me that, you know, that they're struggling in that area. Sometimes I'm a little bit surprised, but I'm really pleased that they've felt comfortable enough to mention it and know that I'm not going to sort of judge them and start treating them differently and, you know, throw them out of the church or something weird. So I think it starts with confession.
Which, actually, just a step before, isn't it?
Yes.
It starts with conviction that porn
dropped. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
You know, it starts with actually being convinced that actually this is wrong,
yes.
This is a sin.
Yeah.
And I think most are in the church, are both professing believers.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it works either one or two ways. I think it either becomes the dominant sin that the whole of their life is marked by, or they know it's a sin, but they're not that bothered by it because actually they secretly quite enjoy it. So, so they're not at that conviction point.
Or perhaps that they know it's a sin, but they don't really know why.
Yeah, no. Possibly.
Because I think that sometimes it can be framed, because we are reticent sometimes to talk about it, maybe with youth and with...
Yeah.
We're quick to say it's wrong
and
it's prohibited and we've got rules, but we're not quick to say, why though?
Yeah.
What is the heart issue that you need to recognise that is the actual problem here? And so what you end up with is just people saying, well, I've just been told I can't do it.
Yeah.
And what that leads to is that kind of white polar bear syndrome of, well, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Because if it's just a rule... And it seems arbitrary to me. So I think
the white polar bear syndrome.
Yeah, no, I was thinking exactly the same.
It was a psychological phenomenon where they did a test where they asked participants to not think of a white polar bear, and in every single scenario, that's all they can think of.
Okay. Yeah.
So I think that's why I wanted to ask you those questions about: is it arbitrary? Is God saying don't do this, and not telling us why?
Because
it's so important, I think, to explain the why. To make it real for people and make it more than just a rule.
Yeah, and I think it's really important. I'm slightly distracted now because I'm trying not to think about white polar bears. But all I can think about is white polar bears on a much more serious topic than that. But yeah, I think, you know, I think we answered already in terms of the why it's wrong, but I think it's really important to keep coming back around on that. And I think having had a sense of conviction and owning up to it, to ourselves, first of all, and then perhaps to somebody else, when I'm talking to someone partially, I'm sure Mark the same, that there's the ministering the gospel of forgiveness and acceptance and in response to repentance. But I think there's also then thinking, so why are you doing this? What's driving it?
The heart issues.
Yeah, the heart issues, because I think that the habit issues come a bit later, because I think there are reasons... Sometimes when you have actually dealt with the heart issues and people are convicted about it, but then there's a habit issue to think about, and that's dealt with, I think, slightly differently when the basic desires.
So, I mean, when we talk about heart issues, we're talking about, you know, what's it's I don't just sit there at a screen kind of neutrally,
no,
as if there's a kind of, this is just a neutral event that I have chosen or not chosen. There's a spiritual battle that is raging, and that is driven by desires of the heart. And often those desires of the heart are, you know, I'm seeking comfort.
Yeah.
So I find comfort from the stress of life, and this feeds that, or it's escapism, or my marriage isn't great, and or my sex life isn't great, so I give myself the excuse, permission to somehow go and watch porn.
Yeah, it's kind of a reward that goes with the comfort as well. That the idea that I've had a tough day, or you know, people have been nasty to me in some way, or I'm just exhausted. So it's similar to the idea.
So it could
of comfort,
be a reward, but... or it could be a comfort from it's been a bad day, and so this is a way in which I seek comfort.
Yeah.
Other than the gospel, I'm seeking comfort. So for others, it could be eating, but for others, it's watching porn.
Yeah.
For others, there is just there is an attraction, a unhealthy, desires that are gripped in terms of sex. Maybe because of a past, actually, sometimes maybe as a teenager or an early 20, explicit kind of sexual relationships, maybe prior to being a believer or being a believer, that then kind of fuel, have kind of opened up the beast, as it were.
Yeah, I think it's also worth saying that for people who are same-sex attracted, there's a particular... Yeah. temptation for pornography, because if they're trying to be faithful as Christians, then there isn't the marriage that they're living in, in which they can be sexually satisfied. So there is, and for them, I think perhaps there's an even kind of greater justification that goes on in their heads to say, well, I'm never going to marry, I'm never going to have these kind of relationships, so at least I can watch them, kind of thing. So I think that's a whole kind of other layer. And, all of it really driven by a selfish idolatry and a sense that we have sort of rights to certain things. We want to sort of try and tackle that, but always in a sensitive way. I mean, in a discussion like this, because we haven't got people pastorally in front of us, we're talking about it in quite clinical kind of terms. Mm-hmm. But obviously when you're talking with someone one-to-one, you're feeling their pain and their all the contradictions that they're feeling about it, all that they're kind of partly justifying but partly terribly guilty about it, and confused and annoyed with themselves, and there's a shame and all those sort of things. And so when you're really talking with someone, you've got to work with that as well.
And that's kind of prompting, it's, although we've been talking about conviction and confession, often I think we want to help people to have a godly sorrow rather than a worldly sorrow.
Yeah.
And I think so often we have worldly sorrows, as in, I feel bad, I know I shouldn't have done it, and I feel guilty.
Mm.
But actually, I'm not convicted, going back to, this is wrong before God, it's wrong before others. And actually, there's not that sense of earnestness or that sense of actually wanting to be right before God. And actually, that deep conviction that says, no, fundamentally, I'm convicted in my core that this is wrong before a holy God who loves me. And when I have the godly sorrow, it gives me the solution, pushes me to the gospel. Worldly sorrow will just push me towards trying to put in legalistic mechanisms that will help me to kind of keep me from feeling guilty. So I'll put in, accountability programs on my computer. Mm-hmm. And I think they work as well in the godly sorrow. But mm-hmm. I think if you only have worldly sorrow, you'll leave it there.
Yeah.
If you have godly sorrow, you're going to be convicted. You're going to confess. You're going to know the truth. So like 1 John, if you confess your sin, he is faithful and just and will, forgive you and cleanse you and purify you. You go there. You're then kind of seeking his grace and his help. You're then looking to the cross for your help, your assurance, your comfort, your strength to therefore fight the battle. And once you've got those, then you're going to start putting in the accountability, because I think accountability is good. You want the things like, covenant eyes, that they're helpful, but they only work if you're going from a godly sorrow to the gospel, not if you have worldly sorrow. Because if you have worldly sorrow, you put in covenant eyes, you'll find the back doors, you'll find ways around it, you'll find the things that are not connected to it. So I think it is having the accountability. I think you then want to take absolute radical measures if this is a battle. So it's not just putting covenant eyes on. It's not just being accountable to someone who you can be accountable. And I think you need to choose that person wisely. So I think it should be a mature believer. It should be someone of the same sex. It should be someone who's not going to be shocked by you confessing your sin. If you're married, sometimes that is appropriate for your wife to be, but actually it may not be the most loving thing. So I think you've got to have the conversation with your wife that says, I'm wrestling with porn, but they may not be the ongoing person who you then are accountable to, because actually they don't want to hear that you've messed up every day for this last week. But they probably do want to know that you're meeting someone who's wrestling with it for you. And then I think you want to take radical measures, which might mean you're going to put your computer in a place where no one else can, you know, everyone else can see you. You're going to have to put on things that just stop even a hint of it, you know, and being open and taking that fight seriously. So I don't think you, if you are wrestling with porn, please do not leave yourself in that position where you're just kind of hiding and ashamed, and that the devil loves that. He loves it in the dark. Bring it into the light with help. And, you know, if it's, you know, your pastor, your small group leader, a mature believer who you know you can talk with, or read a really helpful book, Finally Free by Heath Lambert. I think it's been really gospel-based.
Yeah.
There was just a rhythm of things, just conscious of time's running out, but wanted to say some of those things. I think we want to help people who are wrestling with this, and we don't want them just kind of beating themselves up, going down the godly sorrow. We want them to run to the gospel and to grace and to know forgiveness and cleansing. And
I totally agree with you that as a matter of principle, the things that will change habits always have to follow the change of heart.
Yeah,
it's just, it's not always a perfect sequence. There is some kind of interaction that, to some degree, the habitual watching of it creates a heart desire. So there's a kind of overlap. So I think you need both, and
absolutely
both the heart conviction, but also that heart conviction is not always perfect. So sometimes the trying to break the habit stuff really helps, but the measures you might put in place to try and break the habit, as you say, only work if the heart's actually committed to it. And I think it's sort of connected with this, and it's much, much harder when our children were younger. It was slightly easier to take measures to kind of restrict, to help our children by making what they were watching much more public. So we didn't have screens generally in bedrooms, whether they're televisions or computer screens. So I think that was slightly easier because of the power of the mobile phone and the tablet and so forth. That's more difficult. So you've got to think really carefully as a parent, and these are not easy issues, about, you know, what you do at certain stages. You know, do you make them all charge their phones downstairs, you know, assuming the bedrooms are upstairs?
Yeah, we do.
Quite so, and we did. And, you know, our children are able to commit to that up to a point, but then, you know, what happens? What happens if they're saying, well, no, for whatever reason, and then they've got the whole, if they're at school age, you know, the whole school day where, you know, they might have a device. So it's much, much harder to kind of control all that. Yeah, I know you can put programs in place and all those sort of things, and I think there are things to put in place, but there's also discussions to have with our children. And I think we have a different responsibility than we do with other Christian believers with our own children, to actually, you know, have the conversation, and to keep having the conversation, even though it's awkward and even though our kids might, you know, fly into a rage about it sometimes, but to keep going, that because we love them, and because habits formed in sort of teenage years are hard to break. So we want to just discourage that, you know, because we love our kids. So yeah, that's a whole area to talk about as well.
Well, I think it's probably worth a podcast in itself in terms of using it. But a top tip we found is a gadget called Circle. Circle is you put attached to your hub, and then all your kids' devices and yours go through Circle, and then you control exactly what they're allowed. So my kids get really annoyed with me because Circle suddenly turns off the amount of time they've had, or they're not allowed access to certain websites because it has strong filters on. But it costs about £100, well worth the money. You can extend it out into the world, onto mobile devices as they go out as well.
Right.
So you can, and you therefore get a report of all they've seen, you see, you know, and they know I can see everything. So
yeah.
The all-seeing.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's something else I was going to say.
It's good, it's about breaking habits, or not breaking habits, but not starting habits.
Exactly, helping them to see this. Actually, it's a powerful device, you know, phones. And anyway, we're moving into a whole issue of mobile phones and kids. I think that's a conversation.
But it is in that whole area of the, apart from anything else they might be damaging themselves with the phone, they're watching pornography is another thing.
Yeah.
And it's considered a bit of a joke, you know, at that kind of age. But it's a bit like, in my generation, perhaps starting smoking was a thing to do when you were at school. You know,
it's vaping now.
Everyone was smoking behind the bike sheds, and it's kind of a bit of a laugh, and it's a bit of a rebellion. But actually, it forms a habit that then is really difficult to break.
And hopefully, these new laws will help kind of stop some of it, but it's not going to actually prevent it. We've got to have those conversations.
It's weird, isn't it, that if you think something's damaging to under 18s, you probably ought to be thinking maybe it's damaging to over 18s as well. Now, I mean, there is the kind of malleability of the brain thing
there'd be freedom of an adult.
But. Yeah, to do with violence and all those sort of things as well. Yeah, it is. But it's at least raises the question, doesn't it, to say, you know, if this is so terrible for under 18s to watch, it can't be that amazingly brilliant for over 18s to watch, even though we might want to give them freedom to do it.
Agreed. Final thought, though. I think with the whole issue of porn, sometimes, particularly if you're wrestling with it, it can feel like it is the most dominant sin in your life.
Yeah.
And because of that, it just consumes everything. And actually, it means that on days when I haven't watched porn, I feel amazing. On days when I have watched porn, I feel wretched. And the answer is always the gospel. But it is also recognizing that actually it's not the only sin in your life. And actually, we need to battle with other sins as well in the process of this. But, you know, the gospel does bring freedom and does bring forgiveness and grace and hope. So don't battle alone. Find help. Someone who will point you to Jesus.
And it's worth saying we have an email address, ordinary@cchh.org.uk. It's not monitored by 1,000 people. It's just seen by me. So if you want to write in, make any comments about this, or actually ask for some help, you're most welcome to do that.
Thanks for joining us again this week. As Graham said, do use that email address to get in touch with us, ask us any questions or ask for help or suggest future topics for the podcast. Join us again next week for a podcast all about the lies we believe. See you next time.